Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It was on this day in 1972 that Okinawa, which had been under American military control since it was captured in 1945, was returned to Japan. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, we will tell you how colleges are working to keep students from leaving school before they get a degree. Then, Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she and I take you to a baseball game that is canceled because of rain. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to 1919 and 1920, a time of serious government attacks on personal rights. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day of the year, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And every Sunday, we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Colleges are working hard to keep students from leaving before they get a degree. Now, in our weekly higher education report, Bruce Alpert tells us about those efforts.
Tyler Mulvana worked three jobs last summer, but was still short the money he needed to pay for college. Mulvana, 21, a junior at Georgia State University in Atlanta, got a small gift of money from his college. That allowed him to live at school and attend class. Georgia State used the gifts, usually under $1,000, and other programs to increase graduation rates by 22 percentage points since 2006. The school also watches student performance for early signs of trouble, such as missing classes, not completing work, or low test scores. The idea, said Vice Provost Timothy Rennick, is to help before problems grow and force students to leave school. About 59% of college students graduate within 6 years, according to the U.S. Department of Education. That means many students leave college before graduating. At Georgia State, the rate is 55%, but much higher than 10 years ago. Georgia State is a school with 50,000 students, including many minority students. They are often the first in their families to attend college. Malvena plans to graduate next year from Georgia State, making him the first in his family to complete college. He credits the school with helping him meet the demands of college. An academic advisor helped him organize schoolwork so he could get better grades, he said. Another helped plan a study year in France. For his first 2 years, Malvena traveled to Georgia State from his home in Newnan, either taking a public bus or driving. It took at least 45 minutes, often longer, because of Atlanta's heavy traffic. I would start my commute at 7:30 a.m., return around 4:30 p.m., then work at the YMCA from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m., and then do it all over again the next day, he said. Malvana wanted to live at school his junior year to save travel time and enjoy campus life more. The small money gift from Georgia State made that possible. Rennick, the Georgia State administrator, said the college was losing about 1,000 students a semester because they ran out of money after paying tuition for 3 years. For a very small investment, we are helping more of our students to graduate, Rennick said. Colleges are sensitive about dropout rates. Students and their parents might reject a college that has high dropout rates. For Tyler Mulvena, who is finishing up his junior year at Georgia State, the future looks bright. He is hoping for a good job in business. I hope that whatever I do, I'll be able to do something I've been hoping to do since I was 15, said Mulvena. That includes travel, giving money to good causes, and continuing to serve others, he said. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Thanks, Bruce. And now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Ana Mateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. Today, she and I take you to a baseball game. But the game doesn't take place because of rain.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Baseball is often called America's game. This may or may not be true, but a baseball game is a great place to learn American English. So, let's go to the ballpark. My colleague, Christopher Jones Cruz, invited me to a baseball game recently. Let's hear how it went.
Ana, thanks for coming to the game today. It's going to be a great game. The teams are from two countries. The Toronto Blue Jays traveled from Canada to Washington, D.C. to play the Washington Nationals.
I've never been to Nationals Park before. It's really big. But it's raining. Is that going to affect the game?
Well, the weather experts said the rain in the D.C. area would be intermittent. It's going to rain for a few minutes and then stop before possibly starting again. It'll be fine.
Oh, and don't let me forget to pay you for the tickets.
Don't worry about the tickets. I only paid $5 a seat.
$5? That's cheap.
Seating close to the field for some games can be expensive. Do you see those seats all the way down there behind home plate? They can cost $375. So $5 for a seat is a great deal.
Well, I know you like to save money.
You know, some people from work say I'm a cheapskate.
No, no, they don't say that. Much?
I'm not a cheapskate. I just love the idea of saving money and enjoying the game in the cheap seats.
Oh, I don't mind seats this far away. But you know my eyesight is not that good. In fact, it looks like there's a huge furry animal down there on the field.
There's nothing wrong with your eyesight. That is a big furry animal on the field. It's the team mascot. You know, people in costumes that get the crowd excited.
Oh, well, that mascot is doing a good job. Everyone is excited. Oh, look, they have big screens televising the game. I can watch the game on those.
Those are called Jumbotrons.
That's a cool name. Look at the crowd. We all look funny wearing these cheap rain covers. You know, Christopher, I think the rain is falling harder. And it's been raining for 20 minutes.
It won't be a problem. Trust me.
Attention, folks. We have a problem. We would like to announce that the game will be delayed due to inclement weather.
Oh, the game is delayed.
Yes, I heard that.
It's delayed because of inclement weather. Why not just say the game is canceled because of rain?
I guess they want to sound fancy instead of just saying it's stormy.
Look, many fans have moved inside the stadium. What are those people doing on the field with that big blue plastic thing?
That is a plastic tarp, and they are covering the field. It will keep the field from getting too wet. Teams often cancel games when the field is soaked with water. Baseball players can get injured when they play on a field that is wet or muddy.
Yeah, I guess team owners don't want to lose money if a player gets hurt. They pay some players millions of dollars a year to play a ball game. Unbelievable.
Hey, the rain. It seems to be slowing. Maybe the game will start soon.
I don't think so, Christopher. Look, an official is coming out to check the field. Now, it looks like he is signaling to someone. It looks like a weird dance.
Oh, no. I know that weird dance. Don't do it! Don't do it!
Do what?
We are sorry to announce that tonight's game is canceled.
No. The game is rained out. The field can't be that damaged from the rain.
The field is really damaged from the rain. But keep your tickets. There will be a makeup game tomorrow. It will be a double header. The first game is at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The second game will be played at 7 o'clock. Thank you for your understanding.
See, it's not so bad. You can see two games tomorrow, a double header.
I can't come tomorrow. I have to work.
Oh. Well, I'm off. Can I have your ticket? I'll bring a friend.
Sure. Well, since they called the game, we have to leave the stadium.
At least the officials for the Nationals have a sense of humor.
What do you mean? There's nothing funny about a rained-out baseball game.
Listen, don't you hear the song they are playing on those large speakers throughout the park? Laughter in the Rain by Neil Sedaka.
Perfect. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. The United States Constitution guarantees the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. The Bill of Rights, which is part of the Constitution, protects these and other individual rights. But the government has not always honored all of the rights in the Constitution. In the 1700s, for example, President John Adams supported laws to stop Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Party from criticizing the government. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln took strong actions to prevent newspapers from printing military news. And during the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused innocent people of being communists and traitors. Some of the most serious government attacks on personal rights took place in 1919 and 1920. A number of government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about the campaign that came to be known as the Red Scare.
These actions took place because of American fears about the threat of communism. Those fears were tied closely to the growth of the organized labor movement during World War I. There were a number of strikes during the war. More and more often, workers were willing to risk their jobs and join together to try to improve working conditions. President Woodrow Wilson had long supported organized labor, and he tried to get workers and business owners to negotiate peacefully. But official support for organized labor ended when strikes closed factories that were important to the national war effort. President Wilson and his advisors felt workers should put the national interest before their private interest. They told workers to wait until after the war to demand more pay and better working conditions.
In general, American workers did wait. But when the war finally ended in 1918, American workers began to strike in large numbers for higher pay. As many as 2 million workers went on strike in 1919. There were strikes by house builders, meat cutters, and train operators. And there were strikes in the shipyards, the shoe factories, and the telephone companies. Most striking workers wanted the traditional goals of labor unions: more pay and shorter working hours. But a growing number of them also began to demand major changes in the economic system itself. They called for government control of certain private industries. Railroad workers, for example, wanted the national government to take permanent control of running the trains. Coal miners, too, demanded government control of their industry. And even in the conservative grain farming states, 200,000 farmers joined a group that called for major economic changes.
All these protests came as a shock to traditional Americans, who considered their country to be the home of free business. They saw little need for labor unions, and they feared that the growing wave of strikes meant the United States faced the same revolution that had just taken place in Russia. After all, Lenin himself had warned that the Bolshevik Revolution would spread to workers in other countries. Several events in 1919 only increased this fear of violent revolution. A bomb exploded in the home of a senator from the southeastern state of Georgia. And someone even exploded a bomb in front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, the nation's chief law officer. However, the most frightening event was a strike by police in Boston, Massachusetts. The policemen demanded higher wages, but the police chief refused to negotiate with them. As a result, the policemen went on strike. When they did, thieves began to break into unprotected homes and shops. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge finally had to call out state troops to protect the people. His action defeated the strike. Most of the policemen lost their jobs.
All this was too much for many Americans. They began to accuse labor unions and others of planning a revolution. And they launched a forceful campaign to protect the country from these suspected extremists. Leaders of this campaign accused thousands of people of being communists or Reds. The campaign became known as the Red Scare. Of course, most people were honestly afraid of revolution. They did not trust the many foreigners who were active in unions, and they were tired of change and social unrest after the bloody World War. A number of these Americans in different cities began to take violent actions against people and groups that they suspected of being communist extremists. In New York, a crowd of men in military uniforms attacked the office of a socialist newspaper. They beat the people working there and destroyed the equipment. In the western city of Centralia, Washington, 4 people were killed in a violent fight between union members and their opponents. Public feeling was against the labor unions and political leftists. Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy. Many state and local governments passed laws making it a crime to belong to organizations that supported revolution. 28 states passed laws making it a crime to wave red flags.
People also demanded action from the national government. President Wilson was sick and unable to see the situation clearly. He cared about little except his dream of the United States joining the new League of Nations. But Attorney General Palmer heard the calls for action. Palmer hoped to be elected president the next year. He decided to take strong actions to gain the attention of voters. One of Palmer's first actions as Attorney General was to prevent coal miners from going on strike. Next, he ordered a series of raids to arrest leftist leaders. A number of these arrested people were innocent of any crime, but officials kept many of them in jail without charges for weeks. Palmer expelled from the country a number of foreigners suspected of revolutionary activity. He told reporters that communists were criminals who planned to overthrow everything that was good in life.
Feelings of fear and suspicion extended to other parts of American life. Many persons and groups were accused of supporting communism. Such famous Americans as actor Charlie Chaplin, educator John Dewey, and law professor Felix Frankfurter were among those accused. The Red Scare caused many innocent people to be afraid to express their ideas. They feared they might be accused of being a communist. But as quickly as the Red Scare swept across the country, so too did it end in 1920. In just a few months, people began to lose trust in Attorney General Palmer. They became tired of his extreme actions. Republican leader Charles Evans Hughes and other leading Americans called for the Justice Department to obey the law in arresting and charging people.
By the summer of 1920, the Red Scare was over. Even a large bomb explosion in New York in September did not change the opinion of most Americans that the nation should return to free speech and the rule of law. The Red Scare did not last long, but it was an important event. It showed that many Americans after World War I were tired of social changes. They wanted peace and business growth. Of course, the traditional way for Americans to show their feelings is through elections. And this growing conservatism of the nation showed itself clearly in the presidential election of 1920. That election will be the subject of our Making of a Nation program next week on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul. It was presented by Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe, and we thank them all. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to all of the stories that you have just heard on this program. Well, that's Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. Next week on this program, in addition to the Making of a Nation, we will bring you the latest higher education news. And Ana Mateo will be here, as always, with Words and Their Stories. That's all next Sunday, so don't miss it. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Just go to learningenglish.voanews.com and click Contact Us. While you are there, you can read, listen to, and download our programs. You will also find podcasts, captioned videos, and lessons to test your English skills. And please know that we really do read every message you send us. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour Universal Time, every day of the year. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from The Voice of America.